So anyway, people ask some questions, and I'm going to talk about that. All right, malas. Malas or rosaries. Malas or rosaries are simply, on a conventional level, counters. They help you to count a particular amount of sacred words, which we talked about last year, mantras. The powerful effect of mantras on our psychology, on our body, and on our winds and our movement. And how incredible, powerful certain mantras can be over a period of time. Well, they really are words of power. That I can attest to myself. And in extreme cases where we really, really concentrate, you can actually, you know, I mean, I'm not joking, you know, you can really can stop rain with mantras. Literally, you can just stop rain. Isn't that a great way to pick up a girl? Just think about that. Isn't that a great way to pick up a guy? You know, some girl. You know, recite some mantra. Nah, that ain't gonna work. But my point is this, the real point. In fact, that's how Sharon was impressed. Her partner, you know, stopped the rain. But she checked the weather forecast. It's going to be like that many hours. And said, so, okay, let's go out this time. It's going to stop in a minute. And then Sharon's like, oh, wow, you're a fabulous BOMO. Fabulous. So you see, it can be another method to happiness. Anyways, malas are simply counters. They help you to keep track so you can concentrate. Malas are used to concentrate and used to help you to focus and concentrate on the mantras you're doing and the meditation. Because if you have to keep count of a certain mantra, then you lose counting and meditate, lose count. In the beginning, it's kind of hard because our mind is very dysfunctional. It's not able to, you know, multitask in the beginning. In the beginning. So it's like, I'm kind of, oh, where was I? Oh, what is my meditation? Oh. Then you start all over again. And you say, oh, forget this meditation thing. I'm going out and having a root beer. So malas are simply counters to help you remember where you are and how many you need to do. They are actually used to help you to concentrate. Contrary to what some people think that you know, the whole focus is having a holy mala and it's really fabulous, it's really wonderful, and that's the spiritual practice. No. Malas are not spiritual practices in itself. It helps you to become spiritual because it helps you to focus on what you're supposed to be doing, repetitions. And so therefore, the mala is a counter. It contains 108 beats. 100 is the usual number we count. 8 is for mistakes that we've done. Sometimes we mispronounced unintentionally. Sometimes we skipped. Sometimes we missed. So the 8 is to make up for that. All right, they have other complicated explanations, but I'm going to leave it there because for our write-up, we don't need it so complicated. 108. And the quality of the mala is according to your means. According to your means. But I would recommend you to get malas that last, that are durable, that don't break easy, and that are easy to use. You know, you get a lapis lazuli mala because you can afford it. You know, you get it. It's heavy. Someone offered me one. I was like, oh, lapis lazuli. Give that to me because it's got gold in it. I'm like, oh, gold. Oh, I love it. That's gonna help my meditation. Boy, it's heavy. After a while, you're like, oh, money. I had biceps on this side from using that mala, and no biceps on this side. Oh, it's not practical at all. And you know, and some Chinese Mahayana people, it's not wrong because Tibetans do that too, have huge malas. It's that big and they wrap it around and it, you know, it goes down to the knee and then, you know, when they're walking, Namo Amitofo Namo. Oh my God. And then they carry these malas. It's so huge. It's bigger than my thumb. And it's like, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. And then you got to hold the mala and go, oh. Then Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. By the time you finish, you got Arnold Schwarzenegger fingers, you know? And it's so heavy. And then the biceps, of course, which is not bad, but it's only on one side, so, you know, you show this arm, not that. But I don't see the purpose of those huge malas. I don't see. It's not bad. I mean, if you like it, you know, all the power to you. You huge mala people, great. For me, I don't like it too big. I don't like it too heavy. And I don't like a lot of things hanging off of them because Tibetans put counters on them, which a lot of people like, but I don't like because I find it gets tangled and all that. I like it simple and easy, but good material. I'll tell you why now. Certain practices, certain types of mantras, if you do it with combine it with certain materials, it helps to facilitate the result of that mantra. Example, if you put very calming, beautiful music and you go for crystal therapy, and you know, and then they put this aromatherapy stuff, it does help. Crystals do help certain parts of your body. I mean, ancient medicine or traditional medicine is all made of components that are natural elements, and mercury and, you know, gold and silver, Tibetan medicine is. So it's all elements. So crystals do help. They help, but they, you know, but it's in conjunction with things. So malas do help in conjunction with certain mantras. So if you recite Om Mani Padme Hum and Chenezik or Kuan Yin, you know, in Tibetan we call them Chenezik. Tibetan, he's a he. In Chinese, it's a she. It doesn't really matter. He, she, you know. I think your form is in drag, but never mind. It's still a bodhisattva inside, right? Drag or whatever, who cares? Buddha is Buddha. So anyways, Chenezik, when you recite the mantra, it's very good to have crystal malas. It's not a necessity. It's not a must. It's not that you have to and you don't, oh God, you know, Kuan Yin's not going to bless you. How ridiculous. But crystal malas are very good for Kuan Yin. And bodhi seed malas are very good. Bodhi seed. Because bodhi seed is originally linked to the bodhi tree. The bodhi tree is what Lord Buddha sat under to meditate to become a Buddha. So bodhi tree reminds us. It's not necessarily because, you know, it's not the tree that Buddha sat under. You know, it's a tree that grew 50,000 miles away, so it's a bodhi tree, big deal. That's not the one Buddha sat under. But if you use a bodhi tree mala, it kind of reminds you of your purpose to become a Buddha, and it implants imprints with that awareness that I will be a Buddha, that I want to be a Buddha. So bodhi seed is very good because it's light, it's solid, it's nice, and it's a reminder of where Lord Buddha attained his final release. The bodhi seeds are wonderful. And pearls are very nice, they're precious, and I'll explain why in a few minutes. Wood, any type of wood is all right. Sandalwood's beautiful, fabulous. And these days we have synthetic materials, which is okay too. You know, they don't break, they last a long time, they're synthetic. You know, even glass and all that, because they didn't have all that in Tibet. It's not allowed. You know, you can even have pure coral, up to you. It's really up to you. Because a mala is used as a counter, but in higher practices, because you're not going to remain at your level, you're going to go to higher practices where you recite certain mantras. And as you recite more and more, it energizes your mala. It really does. So what happens when you recite a lot of mantras, it energizes your mala, and the mala becomes a very powerful object, a talisman, a protection. Why do you think a lot of Chinese people hang malas inside their, you know, their car? Because it comes from that reasoning, that someone blessed and holy has done prayers on it, and the energy is there. So malas can contain very powerful energies. And when you recite mantras after you're finished, you blow it on your mala. It becomes protection. Why? The energy of that certain deity that you've been contacting, Kuan Yin, for example, Manjushri, Umarabhasnati, Omani Pimo, it goes right in, and it stays, energizes, and it's yours. Very nice. And in higher practices, in the sutra practices, in the lower practice, the medium practice, whatever, then malas become an object of offering. Example, for convenience sake, it can be used as a mandala offering. So what you visualize in your mala is a string of jewels and diamonds and pearls and rubies and sapphires and amethysts and all the beautiful things you visualize and you offer. So if you actually have a few precious items on it, it's a wonderful offering every single day to offer to the Buddha when you're doing your practices. So therefore, if you have some pearl malas, it's very, very nice because it's nice to use, it's unique, it's different, but it's an offering. You think, well, if I offered it yesterday, today I can't offer it again. No, yesterday was yesterday's reality, today it's yours again. It's a different reality today. So you can have beautiful pearl malas to offer up to Lord Buddha, up to Tsongkhapa when you're doing your meditations. And then on the highest form of practice, this is not a necessity, this is just my own little thinking. When you have malas that are precious materials, you offer it to yourself as a deity. So if you visualize yourself, in the higher practices, you change your reality to the Yidam, the meditational deity. Yidam is one that holds your mind. So that refers to your personal affinity deity that you meditate on to achieve enlightenment. Because, you know, there's 108 different deities. You can't meditate and recite their sutra and mantra every single day. You can't. It's just too much. It's physically impossible, no matter how enlightened you are. And it's not necessary. If you have one, it contains the energy of all. So your lama or your teacher or your guru, when you're ready, you request, he will assign you an affinity deity, that one that fits your particular need, your particular mind, and your particular energy, and your particular way to enlightenment. And therefore, when you have this yidam, and then you receive initiation and you have visualizations of yourself as that deity. When you have these precious items, it's an offering. You know, I offer it to Chenizik. I offer it to Manjushri. And then therefore you can have precious items that are nice, without attachment, without the result of attachment. And in that same meditation, you can have many precious things around you. Maybe you're someone in society. Maybe you are, and you have to keep up looks for business, for your sake of your family, whatever. You know, because the world operates on that convention. You may not. So in your mind, you don't operate on that convention, but outwardly you do with a good motivation. You know, I'm going to have a big fat car. I'm going to have a big fancy house. I'm going to have fancy jewelry because I have to, because I'm in this station of life, so I have to help maintain my family. Out of compassion, you have those things. So in that way, when you have those things, it doesn't create negative karma or attachment. Why? The intention is the benefit. So malas can be used. They're basically counters. And traditionally, you have a center. And then on this side is 21. On this side is 21. Because many practices, your mantra, you recite up to 21. And then after 21, you have something bigger here, if you prefer. Why? Because you want everything is designed not to interrupt your meditation. So when you go to 21 like that, you can feel it. And then you stop. So everything is to facilitate your meditation. And so, and if you're very lucky, if your lama, your guru, has some relationship with you and stuff, and he's offered you a mala, you think it's fabulous. Because most likely your lama and guru or whatever has put his energy in it, prayers, his yidam. So that when you touch the mala and do the practice, it helps to open up seeds in your mind faster. Because someone who's spiritually advanced has the propensity to open us up faster and easier. Much faster. So, or if we have a mala that's blessed by a person that we respect and a person that's attained, or at least is a good person and has good energy and praise, then it empowers our mala. If it's not done, it's okay also. Because every day we bless it ourselves. We can bless. We don't have to be a Rinpoche, but we all can bless. The Buddhas can work through all of us. So it can be of any material. Certain practices require certain different types of mala. Certain practices. And then certain practices require you to use your left hand or your right hand. And which finger? All right? But generally for us, we just use any hand we like, any finger. But for auspicious reasons, when we do the higher tantric practices, which are very profound, if you do the mother tantras, then you use the left hand. If you do the mother tantras, you use the left hand for peaceful activities that acquire peaceful abilities, peaceful forms of powers and clairvoyance, you use the index finger. If you want to increase wealth, increase knowledge, increase harmony, you want to increase prosperity in the area, with those deities, you will use the second hand. Second finger, I'm sorry. So you recite it like that with a particular mantra and meditation, it will increase. Because you have wind channels here. These wind channels activate certain things in your mind that help you go to that direction, that open up things in that direction. And then in the mother tantras, if you want to do controlling activities, controlling weather, controlling spirits, exorcisms, you know, destroying, stopping negativities, then you use the third finger. The third finger is control aspect. It will gain you the power to control certain situations to be a benefit to others. And then last but not least is when all three methods fail, you have to use wrath of ferocity, wrathful methods. For some people, you need wrath. You need to be wrathful. Their minds don't move unless you're wrathful. So to gain that wrathful ability, wrathful is anger without anger. Isn't that beautiful? Anger without anger. You get angry not because you're angry. You get angry is a method. So for wrathful meditations and wrathful, you know, if you're in a very violent area, you know, like a cemetery or near a cemetery or a place that people have been killed and died, it's very wrathful. And every time you meditate, you see things, you feel things, you're uncomfortable, or you feel jittery. It's not necessarily a spirit, but you yourself feel, because the area is very, you know, energized with wrathful, bad energy, and you use last finger. This is wrath. This is controlling the situation around you. And you do particular mantras. If you do the father tantras, then you use the right hand. Left is permissible. You use more on the right. Left represents wisdom, which is mother tantras. Right represents father tantra, which is based on method. Both is necessary for enlightenment. Both are two wings of a bird. It's just which method you go towards. So if we're doing, for example, Vajrayogini practices, Kirupa practices, Kala Chakra practices, Hevajra practices. Kala Chakra, Vajugini, Heruka. Then we would concentrate on the left hand using the first index finger. And we would train ourselves to use that. And then we pull the mala towards us. This is how we use it. We keep it at heart level, concentrate, and we pull it towards us. And when you finish it, when you get to the end, maybe you have to do 1,000, 500, 1, I don't know. When you get to the end, you just continue. You just go over. This is nothing sacred and holy. It's just a marker. Some people turn it around. Not necessary. You just continue. So those who are doing Yamataka practices, we use Samaja practices, then they will use the right hand. Those of us who are not initiated into the higher tantras at this time, you use any hand you like. But if you like to be initiated into one of the higher tantras and you know which one you like or which one you've been told you're going to get, then you would start, example is Vajrayana Hiruka, left hand. Yamataka, Guhya Samaja, right hand. Kala Chakra, left hand. Mother Tantra. And that's not a big deal, but you see, it's another way to help you to gain attainments faster. If you use the wrong hand, like, uh-oh, no effect. No, got effect. There are plenty of villagers out there who, they don't even have fingers, they just recite mantras. You know, they don't have hands, accidents, whatever. They still gain attainments. So these are just to help you. Don't get caught up on this. And if you make it very beautiful, if you make it very attractive, it's nice too. Because some people at that level where they like nice things, so if you give them nice things, they do nice mantras. You give them ugly things, they won't do a mantra. I mean, there's all types of people. So, you know, if you know some guy who's, you know, filthy, wealthy, rich, and everything around him is gold, including his toilet bowls, everything's gold, you give him a crappy little wooden mala that smells, that's misshapen. You hear, the Buddhist pray. He's like, thank you very much. You know, but if you give this guy a pearl, he's like, ooh, I want to recite mantras every day. You know, at that level. And as they do more and more, their mind changes. After a while, it doesn't matter to them. But you attract them at their level.
Just to backtrack a bit, you were saying that...
Oh, you lost the accent. Go ahead. The significance is precious stones are acquired by you having wealth. The wealth is a lot of hard work, blood, sweat, and tears. And with blood, sweat, and tears, if you have money, you can spend it on many things. But if you spend it on something to offer to a Buddha who is an enlightened being, you create the causes for you to gain great wealth again. No, because if your motivation is to get rich as an end to itself, it's feeding desire. Because you're already feeding desire as you are not doing that. Every day. Every single day, whatever you do is to get wealth. You're feeding desire every single day. But it's better to feed your desire through an enlightened being, which eventually will extinguish that. Because if you're a very nasty, ugly person, if you hang around a nice person, eventually you start to transform and change. So like that, if you're going to feed your desire by offering pearls and precious items on a Buddha image, what happens is this, is that every single day that Buddha image contains that item, you collect merit every single day. And when you collect that merit, it transforms your mind. It helps you to switch your mind over to something good, even initially if it's negative. And at the same time, when you offer something precious to an enlightened being, that enlightened being has no desire for it, and he has no need. And on top of that, he has all that he wants. But when you offer it up to an enlightened being whose mind is free from attachments, then you create the causes for you to reach that state because you're making an affinity with that being. And the affinity you're making is not a cheap little glass of yogurt. It's something really that your greedy mind would have normally have not done. But you pull yourself away from your greed to offer it to something that you feel you don't get immediate benefit. So on many levels, it has a lot of effect. Okay? And hence, in Buddhist places, they encourage that. Like in Thailand, gold on the Buddhas. Yes, it is meant as a counter to attachment, a counter. Okay? Now, so when you have beautiful malas, nice malas, for some people it's encouraging. For some people they use it as practice in their daily practice. It's an offering. But it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really, really matter what kind of mala you have. It doesn't really matter. It's basically a counter. And it's pleasant, it's nice. You pick the size that you like. You pick the size that you find pleasant. And you can change it. And it's a wonderful gift to people because it's very meaningful. It's very beautiful. It symbolizes practice. Kuan Yin in the Buddhist, in the Tibetan tradition, four arms, and this arm holds a mala. And this arm holds a lotus. And in these two arms here holds a wish-fulfilling jewel. So in this arm holding a lotus is a reminder to us that by practice, Kuan Yin became enlightened. By listening to her master, Shakyamuni Buddha, she became enlightened. And she became enlightened not by listening, but applying what she heard into practice, into assimilation with her mind. So this mala that she's holding represents assimilation. So when you have a mala and you keep a mala and it's kept well, it's also awareness of your spiritual practice that you need to practice. When you see a mala, what do you think? You're not going to wrap around yourself and go on a podium. I mean, you can, but that's not what you usually associate it with. And higher beings who are very practiced in mantra, who are very practiced in meditation, their malas are very powerful. Because their energy, their motivation, and everything you want to achieve is contained in their prayers, and then it's blessed. And some higher beings can manifest as different meditational deities. So during their meditation, they manifest different meditational deities. It is not them holding it. It is the meditational deity holding the mala and blessing it. So in those kind of beings, if they give you one of their malas, it's very blessed. Why? Why is it blessed? It's blessed because it contains the energy of that deity, which when you touch and you use daily, it will open up that energy in you. And if they cut their mala and they offer it, and you can get one and you can wear it. Very protective. Very, very protective. So on a different level, malas can be used as protection. And in some cases of high lamas, their malas are so energized. They know it. They know it. They actually use the mala to bless people. Example, in the Vajrayogini Tantra and Hiruka Tantras, the mantra is very, very potent for dispelling negative spirits. Very potent for exercising or chasing away negativities, Vajrayogini. So in Vajrayogini's Tantra, it's encouraged to have a nice mala, it's encouraged to have a strong one, and to keep one, and to blow the mantra after you've done, and then with that, you can bless many people. That people who are touched by this mala in the Vajrayogini Tantra actually receive an imprint of her holy blessings. What's her holy blessings? That in the future they can practice. So with Vajrayogini's Tantra, for people to even see the mala of the practitioner, and to be placed on top of the head to be blessed, very powerful. Very, very powerful. So the mala is a counter, is an ornament for the Buddhas, it's an offering to the Buddhas. It is a reminder of spiritual practice. It is a counter to help us focus our awareness and meditation because we're at a rough, gross level. And it can help us attain different types of powers by activating the winds and energies in the different parts of our fingers, in the different parts of our body. All. No problem. We can't, you know, like some lamas, they have to practice 100, 200 deities. They can't have 200 malas. That's going to be pretty heavy. Imagine immigration, they're going to say, you're a businessman selling malas. Text. One mala for all. Even better. No difference, your preference and your hand size. If you're 6'2", that one, probably 21. Those is for short practices, just to wear, and anywhere you can use it. I mean, sometimes it's not practical to have a big long one. So when you wear a little short one like what you have, you can take it off and use it anytime. Yeah, and then let's be a little bitchy. If you're 6'2" and gorgeous and fabulous, then you have a long big mala. If you're not, you have a short one. Well, if you're not, you have a long one. It's going to be like, you're going to have to be like, oh, money, pen, 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 oh. Well, and if you're 6'2" and gorgeous and fabulous and beautiful and Tibetan, then you have a long one that's very elegant because it's nice. Because if it's a little short, I'm like, get it? Good. Any more intelligent questions that might embarrass you? He loves it. Yes, Paris. Because, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of practices require you just to recite 21, and that's the duration of the meditation that is necessary for that particular practice. Just 21. It can be 21, it can be 28. It depends on different practices. And sometimes it can depend on your wrist. Because if you're 6'2" and gorgeous, fabulous, have a thick, wonderful wrist, 21 is going to be a little too tight, so maybe with 23. You know, I mean, don't get caught up on the numbers. That's what's specified, but it doesn't have to be. You have to be practical. So if you're not 6'2" and gorgeous, maybe 21 is going to be a little loose, and you keep losing it, you know? And if you go to an Indian toilet and you wipe yourself the Indian way, which is what we do in India, then your mala goes down the Indian toilet because it's a little too loose. So you do what's practical. Oh, you can get it from right here. That's what we're doing right now. This whole thing is for write-ups. These are writers. I got four writers here. This is a writer. It's yeah. Oh, no. You can get it anywhere else. In fact, you should check several sources so you can get this information. You can check the net. You can check the net. You just put, you know, significance of rosaries, Buddhist rosaries, how they're used. Just check the net. No problem. No problem. Mm-hmm. It's not necessary. The purpose of bone malas is this. That has an energy to help us remember our mortality. That has an energy to help us visualize and feel death. And feeling death and mortality is not a depressing state. It is a happy state because it compels us to do things that bring happiness. If we know we're going to die tomorrow, there's a lot of things we would do today that would be harmful to others. And some of the tantric deities, they use wrathful means. They use wrathful means in order to subdue others. So malas that are of bone represent death. And when you use these malas, it reminds you of the energy you're tapping into to subdue others in violent places. But it's not necessary. It's not necessary, and I don't recommend it. Yes? Katanga, okay. Number one, Lama Tsongkhapa's head doesn't tilt to the side in the normal form. He has five main emanations. One, this is Lama Tsongkhapa. Two, three, four. And the last one there in the form of Mahasiddha, that's all Lama Tsongkhapa. He has five main forms. All right, five main, not restricted. So each of the forms are different and they manifest differently for different purposes and needs. A deity who has the head tilted on the lower tantras, a deity that the head is tilted on the lower tantras, denotes compassion, maternal love, care, and extreme compassion. So what you're doing is it's reminding you of the goal. And it's reminding you that when we reach that goal, we still have to be very compassionate and kind. So a deity that's slightly tilted, like that, like Tara, slightly tilted, it represents the state that they have achieved, which is great compassion, which is equivalent to maternal love, much, much more. All right, that's one. On Guru Rinpoche, in Guru Rinpoche's holy case, when his head is tilted, it represents tantric achievements, where he uses his tantric elements and tantric achievements to subdue. Because Guru Rinpoche was very well known in Tibet when he first came to subdue many, many unnatural, supernatural, unhappy, and very negative forces. So when he was doing that, he wasn't just sitting like that. He had to move this way. He had different rituals and different ways to do it, and different mudras, different actions, different body movements. So him doing that represents activity from compassion. All right? In Lama Tsongkhapa's case, he's usually pictured as straight. Straight meaning mental stabilization. Straight meaning by great meditation. Because when we meditate, we don't do like that. Seeing straight, meditating means represents his people and life through practice. But his different five emanations, example this one, he appeared on an elephant. So that one, the same. This one is the same. When he appeared on an elephant to one of his disciples, Kidurunji, why? He was showing great affection, great love for his student. Because Lama Tsongkhapa is a Buddha. He appears in visions to people very easily. He's very sensitive. And many Lama Tsongkhapa statues in Tibet manifest pills or speak or either very heavy to move or very light. It has unusual ways of manifesting its power. And there's very famous Jerimji statues, which you can read in the Heart Jewel. Very, very famous Lama Tsongkhapa statues of different sizes that have manifested many, many extraordinary signs up to this day. Up to this very day. Lama Tsongkhapa is a very easy deity to practice, very easy to tap into, very easy to hold on to, very easy to achieve because of his nature and who he is and the combination of deities. And his mantra and the meditations are not difficult, but they're very, very effective. So Lama Tsongkhapa, in this form, we call these forms the Jesibanga, the five visions of Jerimchi, Jetsongkhapa. In this form, when he appeared on the elephant represents overcoming ignorance, stubbornness, narrow-mindedness, and Lama Tsongkhapa has overcome that. On a pristine white elephant, because the elephant is not an actual animal, it's an emanation of his mind, to show you his quality. And riding on a white, pristine, clear elephant represents his luminous nature that he has achieved Buddhahood. And him being tilted shows you great love and compassion. I care for you. I'm appearing to you out of love. You invoked me. I appear to you out of great love, great compassion. And in this form, his feet is down instead of a meditation pose, telling you that although he's fully achieved, he's not stiff and hard. He's able to come to you immediately to help. So this form is very, very significant with the head tilted. In the case of tantric deities, the head being tilted represents the type of tantras they are veered toward. Vajrayoginis is tilted toward the left. Kiruka is tilted to the left. Kalachakra to the left. Yamantaka to the right. Left denotes Mother Tantra, focusing on clear light. Right is more on Father Tantra, illusory body. So in tantric deities, when they tilt left and right, it symbolizes the method that they use, that you will utilize to achieve enlightenment. Both is equal. It's just dependent on what you need. All right? So tilting of the head in iconography is very powerful symbology. Very, very powerful. And if you know what it represents, when you look at that deity, you immediately know the path, you know what they're doing, what's happening, what you're going to be engaged in, you understand very clearly. So iconography is not simply beautiful art. It is very powerful symbology toward the awakened state of mind, which reminds you, and when you see it, when you see an enlightened being, a statue or a tanka or whatever, it plants imprints in your mind. It's a direct channel to them. Okay? Now, where was I? Malas. So they're counters. They can be made of precious items so that you can make offerings. And they can be of any size. They can be of any materials. And they can be used for whatever you like. And they can be switched anytime. So if you're going to switch in one mala, don't, oh God, how do I transfer the energy? You know, no, don't worry about it. Because the energy is not really the mala, it's you. If you're attained, whatever you touch becomes, you know, enlightened. You can touch one toilet paper and put on people and bless them with it if you're really that state. Why? Because this is all just a substance. It's earth, air, water, and fire. And the blessings is carried over to someone because they're not able to achieve direct blessing with you. So what happens is it's blessed. Example, we have clothes and we have relics from Lama Tsongkhapa or Buddha. Those are very blessed because it was them. You know, their energies pervaded their whole body and what they wore. So it can be transferred on a tissue, it can be transferred on toilet paper, it can transfer on a mala. So don't think, oh, if I switch malas, how? I need to go see a Tibetan Lama, fly to Tibet and see his holiness, blue, blue, blah, blah, blah. You know, and then you can't acclimatize. So for 3 days there, you're throwing up and you're dizzy just to transfer the energy of this mala to this mala. And then you find out from Temerinji, you don't have to. And you don't have to fly to Shangri-La, Tibet. You can just fly to PJ. Isn't that fabulous? Just in PJ. Wonderful. In the past, people who went for teachings, they walked. Trijanarchi, when he went for the Lamrim teachings, he walked for 3 months from his part of Tibet on horseback and walked the highest Lama in Tibet to central Tibet to receive teachings from his guru. These days, when we have to drive from another part of town, there's traffic. Oh, God, I tell you. If there was a picture of our guru, we'd be punching him. Very easy these days. And so malas on a higher level can be protection. Can be protection. Why? It is imbued with that practice. It is imbued with the power of that mantra. Remember what I mentioned last week without going all into it again. The mantras contain the essence of that Buddha in a form of words. So when you chant that mantra, you're tapping into the energy of that Buddha. You're tapping into its potential and you're tapping into yourself connecting with that energy and becoming one with it. So words of power, as I explained last week, so who missed it, you can get the CD. It's available. Right? Singhya has it produced. It's very, very powerful. So, and then it should be kept clean. It should be kept well. It should be kept in a good place. Why? Because it can become dirty? No. Respecting and keeping it in a nice place is symbolic of your spiritual practice and how you treat it. And it's great gifts. All right, malas. Any questions? Well, if the Dalai Lama says, I want to hold your mala, I'd give it to him. Please. In fact, rub it all over you. You know, if it's a hantu, no. No, thank you. Because if you're weak in energy and they touch it, if a holy being can put good energy on it, an evil being can put negative energy on it. And it can affect you if you're weak. If you're highly practiced, you can give it to all the hantus and they can touch it, bring it back. And when you touch it, you bless them. But if you're like me, a clown, then hantus are, you know, evil people. When you touch it, you go, You know, you turn into the wolf man. Yeah, because touch can affect. You know, sometimes we touch, we feel, ooh, nice. Sometimes we think, ooh. Sometimes we think, got smell too. You know, touch does affect you. So if you're on this kind of level like me, then, yeah, I mean, your friends, your parents, all that can touch it. And they can use it. It's not a big deal. And then worst comes to worst scenario, if it's somebody evil touches it, you think it's evil, you know, because you're obscured, then you take it back, you recite the mantra of your deity. 21 times you blow on it. Om mani padme hum, 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 mani padme hum. It's okay already. You can be your own guru. Yeah. And if you don't believe in you, you bring ang pao, come see me la. But not the teeny little thin ang paos, you know, from OCBC. I'm talking about the big ones with dragons and sticking, fit a lot of things there, so when I get it, I can feel how much. Don't you hate it? You get one of those big ang pao things, you open it, it's $5. Thank you very much. And then some of these small ones, you know, ugh, I'm not going to look at it. Later, you know, a week later, you open it, like, oh, it's 200 ringgits. I should have opened this last week because I needed money for petrol. No, I'm just kidding. All right?
Now when you're reciting,
you attract spirits by reciting mantras? No, I'm not questioning you. I want to understand your question. When you recite mantras, you attract spirits. And what do you think about that? Is that good or bad? Good or bad? Okay, so your question? But if they're just there and it's not good or bad, who cares? Why is it annoying if it's, then it's bad? So it's good or bad? Okay, if it's bad, then you recite your mantras really loud and you tell them to buzz off. And if you're attained, they will buzz off. If you're not, they're going to bug you more. So what you do is when you recite mantras, you generate loving compassion and you realize they become spirits due to the force of their miserliness, stinginess, and their attachment to wealth and money and prestige. And because of that great attachment that they've habituated their whole life, when they die, these people become spirits, very attached. So therefore, these type of people become spirits, and they're still attached to that. So when you fight them back or you hurt them back, they become even more vicious if you're not realized, you know. So in the case of spirits for ordinary clowns like all of us, what we do is when they come to us, we immediately think about our yidams. If our yidams Lama Tsongkhapa, we focus and meditate on Lama Tsongkhapa and relax and develop compassion towards them. Because usually, and people are very angry, you say, I'm sorry. They calm down. So with the case of spirits, the best practice for ordinary beings like us is not to generate anger or to repel them. What you do is immediately you generate compassion. Compassion based on what? They're a spirit and you're not. They harm, you don't. They can't eat or drink or have company and have love, you can. And their result resembles the cause. So if they're a spirit always wanting things and they can't get it, it must be their previous life is extremely miserly and very selfish and they're attached to their possessions. And so therefore, they become spirits. They linger around places that they're attached to. It could be a people, it could be a person, it can be a thing, it could be a possessions. It can be revenge. So with these kind of beings, what you do, the best thing to do is this, is immediately develop compassion. Instead of being afraid of them, because maybe they're not there to harm. Maybe they were there before you. Maybe that's where they died. Maybe they were there for 300 years and you're the invader, not them. So what you do is the best method, immediately, is to take refuge. Take refuge means surrender to an enlightened being and relax. Come under their protection. And then, with great compassion, you think about their level and you generate compassion towards them. And you know what's happening? Contrary to what we're used to, see Hantu, see Bomo, see Tibetan Lama, Mizung Lama, you know, you say, contrary to your normal belief, bless them. They're suffering. They are suffering. No spirit is having a good time. No spirit. Nobody in a war is having a good time. Nobody in a war. No spirit is having a good time. A spirit is a negative reincarnation. They have different levels and different types of sufferings and different lifespans, just like us. But nevertheless, they are still suffering. So when you see a spirit, instead of going back to your habitual thinking, ooh, spirit, I'm going to get it, I'll run, whatever, you know, they're following me. What you should do is generate compassion and love for them and bless them. Bless them with what? Oh, mani bema, go away. Oh, mani bema, I bless you. No, 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 no. You know, this isn't, you don't do that. You know, you're not in a movie with Linda Blair. This is not The Exorcist. You know, and your father, oh, whatever that Irish name was, I can't remember. And, you know, you're holding your Lamrim book and you say, by the power invested in me in 3 jewels, oh, mani pemeho, mani pemeho. No, no, no. You don't do that. Why don't you do that? Because you're going to frustrate them. You're going to get them angry. Blessing comes not just by the mantras. Blessing comes from your state of mind, which they perceive because they have clairvoyance. Blessing comes from your state of mind and your attitude towards them. And they'll feel it. So even if you don't have mantra, if you just generate loving compassion, metta, most cases they go away, or most cases they don't disturb you anymore. In most cases, turn it around. Bless them. Why do you only bless humans that you can see? Why don't you bless non-humans who are suffering also, even animals? Mantras are very powerful with animals. When I go running in Banda Utama around here, you know, when I go jogging and stuff, I always see dogs. I always recite mantras at them. Even they're barking ferocious at me. I just bark back louder, Om Mani Padme Hum. Why? Planting mantras in their mind blesses them. It helps them very, very much. Any type of mantras. So therefore, when we recite mantras and you attract spirits, I don't know what mantra you're reciting, Om all the hantus come to me, Hong Pe. That must be that mantra. But what happens is when you recite the mantras, you bless them. And there are higher forms of tantra, higher forms of tantra where he is correct that when you do certain practices, it is specifically to attract spirits, but it's assumed you have achieved a level where you can benefit them, directly benefit them, subdue them, transform them, and help them to not stay in their state long. There are beings like that, definitely. There's a certain tantra called jit. Jit practice is very powerful. And when you do that, the minute you do that, spirits will come. You'll hear things move. If you're accomplished, you hear things move, you hear, you know, strange sounds, the energy changes. There's a lot of spirits around. And seasoned practitioners like His Holiness Kyabje Sonrinchi, my guru, His Holiness Kyabje Sonrinchi, when he did chit, you would hear noises in the back all the time. It was really weird. And the spirits would come, and he would make offering to them. Why? Make them happy, to give them something that no one gives them. Because usually when a spirit sees us, we run, they don't like us, or they can't see us. They don't get love, they don't get affection, they don't get anything. All they get is fear, hatred, and people using bomos and magic to dispel them. And it makes them more angry. Think from their perspective. They were you. You can be them. They have a lifespan just like you. So you have to understand the nature of the spirits. But there are certain spirits that are inherently very violent and very evil. They've been like that for hundreds of years. There are things. And in those cases, you have to use more fierce means to subdue them. Just why? Out of the compassion of not letting them do more negative karma to harm others. Collect more negative karma to stay in their state longer or take rebirth again as a spirit. So there are forceful mantras, powerful mantras used to what? To chase them, to harm them? No. To subdue their mind in a more powerful way because they're very fierce. The whole purpose of Buddhistic practice is to help another being. The whole practice. There's no practice that chases or scares or damages another being, human and non-human. The whole basis of Buddhistic practice is to benefit even spirits. And if we can reach that level where even spirits, we overcome, we can be afraid, but we can still be compassionate. We can still be kind because we can develop that kind of mind. So therefore, when the spirits come, when the spirits are there, instead of being afraid, take that as an opportunity to generate compassion. Maybe you'll be the difference in their lives, that they stop doing harm to others. So in that way, it's very beneficial. Change your perspective. Change your mode. Look, we've been here for 2 hours. Listen to all the knowledge you got. Even how you view certain things that culturally you've been afraid of, spirits. You can change your thoughts by wisdom, by Buddha's wisdom. This is what I mean about Dharma. You learn a lot. So instead of consistently being in fear out of ignorance, like a rope coil in a corner of a room and it's dark and you think it's a snake, and you have everything you fear about is a snake, and you walk around that room, you run to the other side, maybe you call the fire department, or you know, you call everybody, or you know, the way you react to it, it's a real snake, because that's what you perceive. When you turn on the lights, you feel ridiculous. And if your friend's there, they're probably laughing at you. Similarly, we have a perception about spirits, and it's only one-sided. They're harmful, they're bad, they're evil, and I want them out of my life. No, we shouldn't think like that. Harmful things that come into our life are not necessarily harmful. They can transform us. They can be a cause for us to generate a stronger and better mind. And we can do that with spirits. I mean, you don't run around, at our level, you don't run around and say, come, I'm going to transform, bless you. You know, you're going to have a menage a trois of spirits, you know. The whole circus shows up, and that's in some of them are pretty scary. And if you're not at that level to help them, don't invite it. But if they're around, you have no choice, then bless them. I mean, trust me, I don't run around calling spirits. Yes. Exactly. That's why I say look at the situation. Generate loving compassion. Generate loving compassion, and if they continue, then you stop them. You stop them either by your meditations, by your mantras, soliciting your Dharma protector. Or if you're not capable, you ask your Lama to exercise. But you have to check the situation. It's the same. Good or bad, you generate loving compassion. Good or bad. Why? A being who has reached that level cannot be harmed. Cannot be. Like some people in Tibet, they think, oh, if you do this and this and this, you can kill the Dalai Lama. Ridiculous. How can you kill the Dalai Lama? He's attained. He's a monk. How can we do that? How can we send magic and harm him? No way. Impossible. That's ignorant, superstitious talk that has not studied the Dharma. Ignorant and superstitious and stupid. So if someone sends a bomo to you, there are many ways to protect yourself. That's what I'm going to go through. There's several things like chakras and stuff we can talk about. If we have time today, I'm going to talk about it. And you're going to learn a lot. You're going to learn quite a lot. And so what happens is chakras, rules, protections, what they're for, what deity, how you activate their energy, where you should wear them, where you should keep them, because you don't have to wear them on your neck, and how to use them. I'm going to talk about chakras because I imported a lot from India and Nepal to disseminate here to help people. Because you know what? When I first arrived in Malaysia, I wasn't really into the spirit scene. But I've seen too much in this country that it is real. Why? The arts of spirit practice and bomo and all that stuff and magic and harm is still alive because people still practice it. It was in the West, but they stopped doing it. So it kind of died off, that tradition. But it doesn't mean the spirits died off. Here, there's a real, real danger of bomos. There's a real danger of magic harm. There is real. I mean, there are some people who are just trying to get attention. And there are some people who are, hallucinating. But you have to differentiate because there are signs to observe whether they're hallucinating is real or not. And there are very genuine cases here. And they're not trying to get attention, and they're not crazy. There are certain mantras we can do, certain deities we can perpetuate, protective circles we can visualize when we're alone, and chakras and mandalas and different forms of protection we can wear. And I'm going to talk about that tonight because we have that in our outlets. And the ones I have in our outlets are not commercial. They are made and blessed by my root gurus, whose intention is benefit others. Because my root gurus, they have many sponsors. They don't need to make money from that. But the money that is sold is to cover the expenses. The paper, the mantras, the blessings, the ceremonies, all that. It is not for profit at all. My gurus don't do that. I know them very well. In any case, so we have those things, and I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about it. And it's going to be very exciting because, UFOs, Loch Ness Monsters, spirits, chakras, magic, mantras. It's all exciting, isn't it? We all love that. We don't hear about philosophy that changes our mind. We want to learn how to be a super bomo. Yeah. How to be a super bomo and how to be powerful and walk around with a lot of pride and ego with our, I try to harm me. And then we recite a magic mantra, like one of those Thai movies, and the spirits disappear. But they do have power, the chakras. And I'll explain where the power comes from, on what basis, and why. Because you need to know. You need to know. It'll be very beneficial. But any questions on malas so I can finish off on that and go to the next subject? Any questions on malas? No, right? Okay, good. Now, yeah. Sure. Yes. 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 Well, if you're very ill, and you have your home remedies, that's wonderful. But if you're very ill, it's very good to go to a skilled physician who's practiced, who's studied, who's many years of in that art of finding out, dictating to you what's wrong with you. So similarly, if you go to a lama, his whole life has been dedicated towards that, wouldn't it be more efficacious than yourself just picking? So that's an analogy you can use. At the same time, having said that, you can still pick out whoever you like and practice, because any Buddha you pick is very effective. Any Buddha. But sometimes we need something that counters something within us that we're not aware of. So we need a particular mantra, particular form, particular meditation to counter that faster. Similarly, it's likened to multivitamins, where you can take a multivitamin. All Buddhas are like multivitamins. So sometimes we need an extra dosage of C if we have a flu. So let's say that, you know, we can pray to any Buddha, but we're a little slow to learn, then Tsongkhapa would be fabulous. He would increase our memory. And there's reasons how he increases memory. It isn't just chanting and he blesses and opens. There are reasons. He opens your memory, he opens your mind, he opens your thought, and he makes your mind wider, encompassing, and more accepting. And in that way, he creates a lot of peace in your mind, gives you wisdom. So if you know all that information to pick, it's wonderful. Because if you pick and you do, it's never wrong. But maybe a year, 2 years later, you feel, oh, I think this one's, I didn't know all this information. This is more appropriate. So what do? You switch allegiance? See you later, you know, Manjushri, hello, Vajragini. And then, you know, and then you still don't meet a guru. And then you find out, oh, Chakrasambhava is more exciting. It is very appropriate for me. Bye, Vajragini, hello. You know, you look like a hitchhiker, a Buddha hitchhiker. You know, you get one ride, bye-bye, get another ride, bye-bye, get another. You don't get anywhere. So it's okay. You don't get any disbenefit, none. None at all. Any Buddha will be fabulous if you pray. You still collect merits. You still are able to generate a good mind. You're still able to make an affinity. No problem at all. None. So don't ever have a hang-up about that. We can go to any Dharma store, buy a statue, bring it home, and we can make prostrations, prayers. It's very holy, very wonderful. No problem. And generally good for everyone. No problem at all. It's a multivitamin. Okay? But if we're going to be very serious and systematic in our practice to gain results, then it's very good to refine it. Very good. So what's the best thing? Like finding a disease, it would be very good to go to someone who can define and refine for you. And so you practice on that, so you can reach that point, you can do it. Logical, isn't it? Yeah. Okay.